There was a brief moment in the installation of my exhibition, Dreamwork, up at the Freud Museum, when my scissor blades were a few millimetres away from the famous carpet that lies on Sigmund Freud's couch, as I carefully trimmed the clear conservation film that lies under my porcelain and black satin artwork, Eros. There he is. And I felt the full weight of responsibility and privilege bestowed on an artist who has been given access to such a historic site. This access is, as you've heard, the result of a three-year research project, Ceramics in the Expanded Field, which my colleague Claire has so clearly presented to you. And it is an excellent example of the relationship of contemporary art practice to academia in the UK today. The Arts and Humanities Research Council is a key source of funding for academic research through art practice, defining research in terms of questions, context, and methodology. Initially, this can seem like a challenge about how one defines one's practice, or even a limitation that could dictate where the practice travels. But the reality is that these definitions can offer a rich and varied way of developing as an artist. The research culture at my university and the requirements of the funding source, far from being a restriction, have, for example, enabled me to recognise and to examine more deeply the importance and significance of archaeology as a central reference in my work, as well as encouraging me as a member of our Ceramics Research Centre to address the expanding field of ceramic practice in areas such as installation, intervention, and site-specific response. There are many strands of thought that have led me to this place: figurative, narrative and theatre, archaeology, psychotherapy, mythology and history have all played a part in my life and my various artworks. And in the past, my interest in the contents of museums was mainly focused on classical antiquities and archaic fragments. And together with my ongoing engagement with the figurative tradition, this has informed much of my narrative-based practice over the last decade. The installation Fragments of Narrative in 2000 in a derelict power station in Wapping offered me the opportunity to respond to a specific space and to a site with history, as well as to explore ideas about clay as a symbolic material connected to myths of origin, such as the golem and Prometheus. This large-scale body of work opened up possibilities to develop floor-based groups of work, such as the series Between the Dog and the Wolf, made in 2003-04, which explored themes around change and metamorphosis, whilst referencing archaeology and museological practice. My first specific engagement with a museum collection was in 2006, when I made a body of work inspired by the Petrie Museum of Egyptian Archaeology in London, a collection that mainly houses small everyday objects rather than grand treasures. The installation, Collective Traces, was shown in the adjoining Institute of Archaeology, and then later a section of it was placed directly into the Egyptian galleries in the Manchester Museum, in an intervention entitled Afterlife. In this context, reinstalling or reframing sections of a work for display in another site raises questions around the nature of the work as theme-specific rather than site-specific, which helps me to define my own criteria as an artist who responds to idea and concept rather than the specific demands of a physical space. Collective Traces indirectly informed a range of human-animal hybrids after a residency at Hunter College in New York in 2006, where I focused on the use of hybridity in Egyptian deities and explored the potential symbolism of this imagery in contemporary practice. These characters have developed into a group entitled The Uncanny Playroom, which were displayed last year in a non-traditional gallery space, the larder of an empty Georgian house in central London. Within this context, our group application to the HRC for funding to the Ceramics in the Expanded Field project led me to address my relationship with the museum more specifically and understand how that informs my work as an artist. As many of you know, the phrase expanded field was coined in 1978 by art historian Rosalind Krauss in her seminal essay, Sculpture in the Expanded Field, to describe areas of practice which resisted the modernist definitions of sculpture. More than three decades on, the term feels apt to describe the shifting boundaries in which the ceramic discipline finds itself, and the museum is an important stage for much of these developments. In my research for the project, I did not want to limit my response to ceramic objects only. My interest in museum collections is broad-based in material terms, and I want to explore the role and significance that objects of various kinds can have in our lives. Making a body of work in the Freud Museum, which could have a dialogue with Freud's ideas, was a very appropriate aim for me, therefore, given my interest in archaeology, archaic figurative artifacts, narrative histories, and my personal experience of the analytic process. And I'd like to record that I do feel immensely privileged to have been able to access this museum collection and to show my work in that house. And I warmly thank Carol and all the staff at the museum who've made the show Dreamwork possible. The project has given me a special access and connection to the lives of Sigmund and Anna Freud, and the rewards for me have been considerable. In choosing the title of my show and its expanded version for this talk, I'm not claiming to have studied and understood Freud's dream work theory in any great depth, but his definitions of representation, condensation, compensation, and repetition reflect ideas that I think relate to art practice, and dreaming and working seem to be one way to define the artist's process. Reflection in action is another way of expressing what can also be understood as the process of research. In particular, two of Freud's definitions appeal to me. Condensation, where two images can be fused together in a dream, of which the Egyptian hybrid figure is a good example. And repetition, which resonates in the processes of molding and casting that I frequently use in my ceramic practice. Added to this is the stream of unlikely narratives to be found in the dream world and its connection to the uncanny, the random, and the surreal. There is an atmosphere within the house in Maresfield Gardens which is familiar to most museums that were once the home of someone significant. A large museum has a certain resonance and is often compared to a modern-day church, but the house of an individual holds a particular aura, a special impact, and presents me with an added sense of responsibility. In the past, charged spaces such as Napoleon's study at the Chateau Malmaison and Barbara Helpworth's studio in St. Ives had a profound impact on me. The visitor and the artist are intervening in a domestic home, a personal space. The personal space has become a public space. The rooms have atmosphere, the sense of a presence, as though the renowned former occupant had just left the room. The viewer connects to and identifies with them, and she is reminded of her own domestic space and the importance of the arrangements of the objects within it. The Freud Museum guide suggests, quote, "An atmosphere is instantly sensed, but not so easily explained. Because the museum is the scene of Freud's absent presence, every visitor can project his or her own emotions onto the study or free associate on the objects on display." In her book, The Sense of the Interior, Diana Fuss has examined the arrangement of the private rooms of some key writers and thinkers of the modern age, including Freud and Proust, examining how the structure of, for example, Freud's study in Vienna informed the development of his ideas. She quotes Freud's own depiction of the unconscious as a bourgeois interior with an entrance hall, a drawing room, and a threshold in between. Donald Cuthbert in Sigmund Freud and Art also writes about Freud's description of the psyche. Quote, "The house of psyche is not simply built on a foundation of memories. It is a mansion composed of many rooms of memory, each built at a different time, and often on the ruins of other memory rooms." In approaching making work for my exhibition, the key area of reference was Freud's collection of over 3,000 archaic figurines and sculptures. And the main work in the show, Sleepover, is a response to this famous collection. Freud significantly purchased his first antiquities after his father died in 1896, and he remained an avid collector of ancient objects all his life. His study contains this large collection, which informed his use of the archaeology metaphor through which he presented his psychoanalytic theories to a sceptical public. In Begasa, Vienna, and here in Maresfield Gardens, the collection was an unnerving presence in his study and consulting room. Dionysius writes that Freud endowed his, quote, most beloved possessions with human characteristics and explored their own status as mute, mortal, and material things. Referring to the photographic records, which we see here, by Edmund Engelmann, Fuss likens Freud's office to a museum. Quote, like all museums, this particular memorial site doubled as a mausoleum, showcasing the self-enshrinement of a collector buried among his funerary objects. Donald Cuspitt writes, for Freud, they literally were preserved pieces of the mind, petrified parts of the psyche. Freud, he says, used archaeological language to structure his concept of the psyche and to make it accessible to the non-medical, if educated, public. The analogy associated an unpopular, suspect enterprise with a popular, respectable one. Freud, he says, was taken with archaeology, not only because of the unusual findings it promised, which psychoanalysis also promised, but because the psyche itself seemed archaeological in character, that is, a realm of relics and ruins. Louise Bourgeois, however, whose exhibition relating to her years in psychoanalysis was shown at the Freud Museum recently, suggested another view and refers to the figurines as Freud's toys. She considers the archaeology metaphor as cheap and argued that they did not help him in his work because his approach was scientific. It's true, she writes, that psychoanalysis can be equated with digging, but the analogy is a cheap one. Any time we are presented with a problem, you dig, so the metaphor is obvious. More revealing than Freud's archaeological language is his use of terms from physics and mechanics, like energy, condensation, and displacement. He wanted to be scientific. And she continues, I also think you have to see the enormous threatening presence of Jung behind Freud's collection. Jung really deduced his theories from his knowledge of antiquities, although he overdid it. But Freud was a reasonable and scientific man. He was content with these little trifles, but they did not engage his intellect or his ability as a doctor. And she suggests he needed the comfort of this evidence of past civilizations to provide some relief when he was faced with the wrecked lives of his patients. But compare this view to art historian John Forrester in his essay Mille Traits, Freud and Collecting. Quote, Freud's desire to be an archaeologist of the mind was a long-standing feature of his inner life. Stones talked to archaeologists, he asserted, in 1896 in one of his first analytical papers, and in exactly the same way, so do forgotten buried memories talk to the psychoanalyst armed with the technique of free association. Freud housed his collection in his workrooms. Forrester suggests this is a clear indication that his collection was both something private for him, to be kept separate from his familial existence, and that it was something bound up with his work, both as a writer and as an analyst. Forrester continues, Freud's collection was undoubtedly his treasure. While he was alive, adding to it, it too remained alive. When he died, it became a museum piece with labels and attributions, and became subject to rules not applied to other objects that belonged to Freud. Yet it still remains true that the collection's principles of unity stems from it being a part of a larger museum of memorabilia, of souvenirs, rather than of authentic antiquities. The collection has become a museum within a museum of precious ancient objects within an ordinary house in Hampstead, full of ordinary fin de siècle Viennese objects, where a great man died. I'm not sure where John Forrester lives, but you get the point. While it's true that Freud wished to be seen as a scientist and that Carl Jung explored world mythology in greater depth to inform his practice of analytical psychology, the fact that these figurines occupied Freud's working environment seems to illustrate his need for them in more than the casual way that Bourgeois suggests. I find the archaeology metaphor a very satisfying one to describe the therapeutic process, and being a figurative artist, the starting point for my research was to focus on the collection and try to explore a little the significance these objects may have held for Freud and the parallel between these modernist practices of archaeology and psychoanalysis. Housed in his study, some of his collection is very hidden, while others take pride of place as favourites on his desk. I chose some of the more obscure characters to study and to develop into the crowd of figures entitled Sleepover, which is displayed in the exhibition room, once Freud's bedroom. The tiny figures have been reworked as larger child-sized characters without the need for exact representation, and many of their body parts have been mixed up and reassembled in a kind of three-dimensional collage. As a child, I had a school rather similar to Walter Potter's late 19th century rabbit school, and all my dolls and teddies had their own personalities and levels of ability. And so a key theme within my figurative narrative-based work is that since human beings project a range of emotions onto objects, these objects have a life of their own. This desire is played out in our earliest child play and fantasies. The overall exhibition title, Dream Work, making passing reference to Freud's definitions of the dream process, suggests an uncanny narrative out of our control where unlikely connections and associations can occur. Drawing a parallel between falling asleep into a dream and leaving the museum, I suggest that in Sleepover, a narrative has been interrupted, which may resume at any time, and that these inanimate objects may become animated when we are not looking, in ways that are beyond our control, like dreams. Animation is a key area of reference in my work. I can trace its influence indirectly back to my early doll school and my youthful ambitions in theatre. Myths and legends were a strong part of my education, and I have an ongoing, sometimes conversational relationship with the characters that hang out in my studio. I've also been influenced by animation films, especially those made by Czech surrealist Jan Švankmajer and the Quay brothers, who have inspired me in my aesthetic and formal style and frequently informed my work through content that engages with narrative, power games, and the stuff of dreams, if not nightmares. The Quay's films are sometimes based on European tales such as E.T.A. Hoffman's story The Sandman, later examined in Freud's essay The Uncanny, which can inspire dread and fascination around the idea of the animated figure. They also admire the writings of Bruno Schulz and created their own version of his 1934 collection of stories, The Street of Crocodiles, in their film of the same name, made in 1986. Exploring ideas about the life within inanimate matter in these fanciful tales, Schultz's leading character declares, "There is no dead matter. Its inertia is merely an outward show behind which untold forms of life lie hidden." And he warns his audience, waxwork figures, beware making light of them. Matter does not know how to take a joke. It is eternally filled with tragic solemnity. Have you any idea of the pain, the silent suffering of that dummy that doesn't even know its own purpose? Have you heard at night the terrible howling of those wax dolls locked inside their fairground booths, the doleful chorus of those hulks of wood and porcelain beating with their fists against the walls of their prison? Who knows how many are the afflicted, crippled, and fragmentary forms of life of armoires and tables nailed together in haste, crucified wood, quiet martyrs to the cruel inventiveness of human beings? In his essay for the book that accompanied the exhibition The Uncanny Room, co-created in 2002 by one of our speakers here today, Janice West, at Pitts Hanger Manor, Adrian Forty writes, "It has been the whole purpose of enlightened thought to banish superstition, to rid the world of things that come to life, of objects that carry talismanic powers. Enlightenment thought regarded such things as symptoms of previous ages when people were at the mercy of their religious and superstitious beliefs, and it was the purpose of the enlightened thinking to reverse this relationship, so that rather than being controlled by their surroundings, people controlled their surroundings." But he continued, "The strength of enlightenment's rationality depended upon knowing what it was that was being suppressed. The excessive rationality of modern design was only possible because at some level there was still a fundamental belief in the magical power of objects. Though my rational self knows the clay figures in my studio are dead matter, I often speak to them, especially when the eyes get made, and I find myself silently addressing them when I lock up at night. Objects become animated when we leave the studio or the museum. It's part of the human imaginative and cultural activity, researched and expressed in a range of disciplines, from anthropology through to popular movies such as Toy Story and Nights at the Museum. My challenge in Sleepover was to achieve the sense that these characters had been interrupted in their own preoccupations. Presentation and grouping within the space had to be addressed to engage the audience with this sense that they had disturbed something and were even being silently reproached for it. And to assist this sense of alienation, my approach has been to create a tableau-like installation in the empty exhibition room rather than one that can be accessed from all directions, thereby creating a distance between the viewer and the figures in which attention can be experienced. A different approach was required in the intervention I Pray Again, Again, displayed in child psychoanalyst Anna Freud's room. Cast in porcelain with their faces smothered in wax, the work is based on a pair of ex-voto figures of children from contemporary Brazil, where the practice of offering a gift to the church in return for healing still exists. Porcelain is a difficult material with a memory after firing. Wax seals in communication and acts as a preservative layer. The ceramic techniques of press molding serves well as a making method with its potential for repetition and its production of multiples, as well as the metaphorical associations with the cast that relate to the multiplicity of the human race. We are cast in the same mold, and yet we are all different. In I Pray, there is a compulsive obsessiveness about the repetition, which is based on my own childhood prayers at a traumatic period of my life when my mother was terminally ill. This work required an intervention within the space in which the figures crop up again and again at various points in the room. The repetition represents a compulsion that reenacts the original childhood trauma and illustrates the need to ask for help through the votive power of prayer, a desire that can remain even when one has ceased to believe in a deity who can assist. The other artworks in the exhibition also make reference to the significance of the figurines for Freud and his use of the archaeology metaphor. My desk is a collection of personal reference objects that inform my practice, and it refers to the lineup of certain favourite objects on the desk in his study. John Wood suggests that for Freud, his sculptures, quote, represented concrete three-dimensional evidence and proof of the workings of the ancient human mind. The pieces that Freud assembled offered embodied and embedded myths, demonstration models and symbols, ancient vestiges that had survived into the present and which offered touchstone to the past. The fact that Freud positioned these sculptures on his desk, so near to him as he worked, underlines this. And he goes on to describe the lineup on Freud's desk as containing, quote, objects from a range of time, places and cultures, creating an ensemble that, although limited, has the look of being as worldwide as it is world deep, a mini desk-bound museum without walls. And in his examination of Freud's desk and chair, Ivan Ward writes, The desk and its contents were both stimulating and emotionally stabilizing in a way that allowed Freud to embody his ideas in writing and to link these ideas together. This is not just a matter of intellect. Object is a key word in psychoanalysis, as internal object, love object, phobic object, fetish object, transitional object, and more. Freud's desk bears witness to the difficulty of conception, as he called it, and the struggle he waged to face the objects in his own inner world and bring order to the chaos of mental life. This quote from Ivan, to me, is a clear and familiar definition about the processes and challenges and outcomes of art practice. Although the intervention Peter Teddy Shabti was first made in 2006 as part of the exhibition Collected Traces, my response to Petrie's Egyptian collection, it felt appropriate to introduce these transitional objects into Freud's collection in his study. A significant symbol of attachment, these teddies, based on my old pre-war teddy bear, which was handed down to me by my eldest brother, refer to a second function as Shabti figures, the servants of the deceased who tilled the earth to provide food in the afterlife. They are made of the magical turquoise material known as Egyptian faience, which was held in high regard by the ancient Egyptians and regarded as a semi-precious stone and a symbol of life and immortality, despite being composed of common materials from the earth. And finally, my Eros, based on the materials and design of a Victorian doll, lies on Freud's couch, which is in itself a controversial issue for some. The doll holds powerful associations. In On the Wax Dolls of Lottie Pritzel, the poet Rilke hopes for life in what seems lifeless. He writes about the child's search for the doll's soul and its lack of response. Quote, "The speculations of man are amusing and noisy. The doll is above all this, infuriatingly divine in its silence." And he continues, "Are we not strange creatures letting ourselves be guided to direct our earliest inclinations to where there is no hope of response? But we hope for some response through therapy." In Freud's collection, Eros is a lively winged figure of history poised with elegance and animation. But here she is in need of some coherent inner structure. A fully dressed Victorian doll appears to be very well adjusted, but it is all surface. Without her finery, she reveals her soft inner substance and lack of structure, and is in need of what the couch may offer by way of healing. This exhibition, Dreamwork, is not a response to a ceramic collection, but a response to symbolic objects and themes. The Freud Museum holds not only a collection of artifacts, but also the traces of real lives, the aura of occupancy, and the connection to massively influential ideas. It's more than a storage house, it's a house with resonance and history. Working on this project has encouraged me to take my practice forward in various ways. Figurative representation is a rich vein for continued exploration, part of a long history which taps into our childhood relationship with objects and is reflected through popular culture. The focus on museum collections allows me to develop and better understand other artworks that I make and to see where my work fits in the dialogues around contemporary figuration, both in ceramics and in the wider field of sculpture. When I was developing my art in the 1980s, ceramics was often held back by a sense of a moral high ground around what clay should be. In those early years, I often felt dogged by the limitations of context placed on me by a material-specific discipline. Although a craft world conservatism and a fine art world prejudice still linger, which needs some attention in terms of context and value, a new generation of ceramic artists are challenging old rules and breaking down boundaries. I welcome this expanded field, which reaches out beyond the normative ceramic dialogue and allows me to place my work in such a stimulating environment as the Freud Museum. Our project, Ceramics in the Expanded Field, aims to contribute to this challenge through a deeper understanding of this long relationship between ceramic practice and museum culture. and despite the recent decline in ceramic-specific courses in higher education, I owe debt to academia for helping to drag this discipline into the 21st century, where many debates and dialogues in a context such as this can occur. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Christy. If I can just ask you to stay there for one second. The structure of the day is that we're going to have a panel discussion in the afternoon. Therefore, we're going to keep questions to a minimum after each talk. But we have a 5-minute slot for any questions in immediate response to Christy's presentation. So can I open it up to the floor if there's any burning questions now? If not, you can think of questions for this afternoon. Christy, can I ask a question myself?
You can, do you?
You've obviously spent a great deal of your life looking at antiquities, and archaeology has been a constant theme. And obviously this was, this related very much to the collection that Freud himself, compiled in his house. Yeah. Making the exhibition, what were the differences? Because you were actually looking through Freud's eyes at his objects, as opposed to the way in which you've looked at these objects yourself at earlier stages.
It's a very eclectic collection, Freud's collection. It's a really mixed bag of objects. And so I was kind of conscious that, he bought and collected and got given things. They can be sort of, roughly, they are pretty archaic. They're ancient Greek or Egyptian form. But his approach to collecting was a very emotional, intuitive one. And some of those pieces are actual fakes. I mean, I don't know how many, and obviously the curators will have it. But I know that, they're not all totally authentic. And so I think that sense of this sort of very democratic kind of collection where he bought, like a lot of collectors, I used to work in craft retail, and I knew about ceramic collectors, and quite a lot of them just bought from their heart in a very intuitive way. And so I think that was really the way that I approached looking at the objects. When you've got 3,000 objects to look at, all you can do is kind of pick on certain ones that really appeal to you. But I was also really trying to pick on ones that were quite hidden, quite obscure, that were not his favourites, were a little bit neglected and tucked away in the backs of cupboards. Because I sort of thought that, kind of related to some buried content of the unconscious that I was trying to drag out and foreground. And in fact, I made a little, if you go up to the house, there's a little cabinet at the bottom of the stairs which features the ones that I picked on, but it is quite an intuitive choice, really. I did a lot of drawings, and certain ones said, "Here, me over here." I'm one of them.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes.
Sorry. Agent. I'm not sure what you mean, I'm sorry.
Would you like to clarify your use of the term agency?
Sorry. That they can elicit response from others, emotions, thoughts, that they have the sort of ability to elicit and to create.
Oh, I hope they do. I very much hope they do. The thing about being any kind of artist, you make things and put them out into the world, and after that you lose, you have no say in what response they evoke. So, I can have an idea about a piece of work I make, and as a figurative artist, obviously, there's always a kind of an element of projection. You know, you put things into a figure and you put it out into the world, but someone else is going to give it a whole other bunch of projections to do with their own experience. So, they hopefully do evoke emotional response, but I've got no control over what that may be once it's left the studio and gone into an exhibition or a home or, you know, the public domain, basically.
Time for one further question. Yes.
Hi, thank you. I was really interested in the point that you made about Eros on the couch being a controversial issue. Would you be able to expand on that a little bit?
I think it's because, you know, as one of the staff tactfully pointed out to me, people come 3,000 miles to see that couch. So, you know, like all good house museums, there are these sort of this sense of a shrine in certain areas, and of course the couch in Freud's, in the context of Freud, is the central shrine of that house. There was quite a lot of debate between us about whether we should or shouldn't put a piece on the couch. And then it was agreed that the work had, you know, relevance and integrity. I wasn't allowed, however, what I wasn't allowed to do is to put a seated figure in the chair behind the couch.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.